The Contenders is a proud member of the Cage Club Podcast Network.
For other great shows about movies and pop culture, go visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
This can't be happening.
Oh, what's happening, Aura?
What did you do to my uncle's house?
I fixed it.
Man, this is so inappropriate for this vehicle.
Why am I operating the untested nuclear laser?
You have the longest arms.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Oh, did you want to?
Sorry. I'll let you.
Next time.
Welcome to The Contenders, the show about the movies made by and starring women who refuse to play by the rules. I am Tobin Addington.
And I'm Aislinn Addington. And today, I'm so excited. We have a guest. Our guest is Dr. Dana Showalter. Hi, Dana.
Hi.
Hello.
Dana is a professor of communications at Western Oregon University and has written academically on this very film.
Yay.
We've never had an actual expert on the movie on our show before, so I'm a little nervous, I'm going to say.
I wouldn't call myself an expert on the movie, but I'll do my best.
So the movie in question is the 2016 Ghostbusters reboot. I guess let's start with Tobin. Mm. Can you share your history with this movie with us?
Yeah, I saw it 2 days ago for the first time. I had wanted to see it. Aislinn, did we have plans at one point to go together or something?
Probably.
I have a vague memory that there were various plans in my life to try to get to this movie, and then with young kids, I have a hard time sometimes getting things into the theater. So I was very excited to have a chance to see this movie. Aislinn, what about you?
I was also excited, and it made me, I remember I was just saying, I watched the original the summer this one came out just because I knew I had seen it, but I had forgotten. So I tried to do sort of a direct comparison that way. And so saw it once then, and then once, yesterday. Dana?
I have a habit of going to see women-led films in the theater on opening day. So, and this was before I had a kid. So I went on opening day and was really blown away by the movie, because at one point I looked up and I saw four women engaged in physical combat, but also wearing clothes at the same time. And I mean, it sounds so funny, but I was really struck in that moment that this was something that was very unique that I have not seen before. And I was blown away. And then I also loved it because when I went out into the lobby after the film, there were several little boys who had gone to see the movie with their moms, and they were asking their moms if they would take pictures for them in front of the the poster for the movie. And I was, I've been hooked. I love
it. That's awesome.
That's so cool.
That's the best
That's so
story.
Cool.
Right?
Yeah, you win. You win.
Yay!
Dana wins segment number one.
Yes, exactly. We do keep points on this That's on the show.
Yeah. That's what I heard, yeah.
Segment two. Tobin, your two bits of film history for us.
Yeah, so the first bit is that this movie had a long journey to come to the screen, apparently. The original film came out in 1984, and then the sequel in 1989. And there was a thing in Hollywood at the time, in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, where the studios were giving away a lot of power to the stars. And so in order for any sequel to get made, the director, Ivan Reitman, and then the two writers, Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis, who were also in the movie, and Bill Murray, all had to agree to do a sequel. And if one of them said no, they could veto the whole project. And so for years and years and years, there's a variety of scripts that get written by a variety of people, sometimes by Dan Aykroyd, sometimes by new writers to the movie. And for whatever reason, often Bill Murray, who's sort of mercurial that way, they never kind of found their way to the screen. And then Harold Ramis who was, as I said, was one of the original co-writers and co-stars, passed away in 2014. And that's somehow the interviews allude to that sort of paving the way for this adaptation. So then we get this adaptation co-written by Paul Feig and Katie Dippold, who shows up in the movie as a real estate agent briefly. And it gets everybody's, gets the remaining three principals' blessings to get made. The other bit is that the Leslie Jones character was originally written for Melissa McCarthy. After, I forget how, what prompted it, but at one point, Paul Feig, as they were sort of casting the movie, realized that he wanted to, he wanted to unleash Leslie Jones the way he did Melissa McCarthy in Bridesmaids. So he knew it would be a real sort of show-stopping part. And also, I think, as I understand it, Melissa McCarthy was sort of wanted to try something else, right? Wanted to do a different kind of role. And so, yeah, those are the two bits I've got.
I love it. I'm hoping we get some more context and background and things from Dana as we get into our discussion because of your interaction with the controversy and et cetera around it. So I'm looking forward to your bits as well, Dana.
All right. Sounds good. I have a bit I can add to the Paul Feig and Katie Dippold, like doing this. So when Paul Feig first said he would do the film, he originally didn't want to do it because he liked the original so much and knew that it had such a cult following. And he's given a lot of interviews saying, you know, I didn't want to do it, and then was trying to think about how he could do it. And he decided he would do it, but only if he could do a reboot specifically, because he wanted to take the idea of the originals, but put it in a completely different context with different people so that he wouldn't have to be like, you know, be a part of or the world that existed before. And so the only reason he did it is because he could do that and create these new dynamics. And so it was this really intentional way of paying his sort of homage to the original, is why he says he did it the way that he did, to like try to do away with some of the backlash that he would have of rebooting this sort of classic, which obviously failed, but yeah.
Traded in for different backlash,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Baggage for baggage. Cool.
Right.
Aislinn, why don't you tell us some of the ladies in charge, women involved in major roles in Ghostbusters?
I would love to. Got to take a big breath because there's a lot more this time than the last time we recorded this podcast.
Yes, it's true.
Lead actors, Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, Kate McKinnon, and Leslie Jones. Co-writer, Katie Dippold. Producers, Ali Bell, Jesse Henderson, and Amy Pascal. An editor, you know I love an editor.
You do.
Melissa Bretherton. So many dings. I missed the dings last time.
I know. We've been low on dings. Yeah. For a couple, I think. Yeah.
Hey, Tobe, can you give us a short rundown, plot rundown for any listeners who haven't been able to catch this one yet?
Sure. This comes from IMDb. Following a ghost invasion of Manhattan, paranormal enthusiasts Aaron Gilbert and Abby Yates, nuclear engineer Jillian Holtzman, and subway worker Patty Tolan band together to stop the otherworldly threat.
Concise, succinct.
Yeah, that's, you know, I mean, it's it feels like there's enough cultural penetration for Ghostbusters. Is that not maybe the way to say that? It feels like cultural osmosis, if not having seen the movie, Ghostbusters is a pretty known quantity. So this is a rebooted Ghostbusters. And if you know the plot of the original, you know the basic outlines of this movie too.
You know, now I'm going to say cultural penetration at least three times before the end of this month. It's going to be my new favorite phrase.
Now I have to leave that in too. I was going to take that out.
You can.
Curses.
So I have a question that I'm hoping Dana can answer or comment on based on the work you've done around this. So to start things off, what's sort of missing from the plot rundown is the catalyst for the ghostly threat is this sad little man, Rowan, who, to me, exemplifies fragile masculinity and is doing all these things and bringing on the end of the world in part because of how he feels mistreated in our world. So that so parallels some aspects of the controversy and backlash. And so I'm wondering, number one, how that character felt to you, Dana. And number two, how much of that character was influenced by the backlash?
I don't know the answer to that question, how much he was influenced by the backlash. I know there were parts of the film that were influenced by the backlash, including things like the moment where they're kind of looking at the YouTube comments on the trailer that they put up early in the film and they start reading comments. Those are actual comments from the YouTube comment section of the trailer that they then use to talk about the movie they put up of themselves catching ghosts. They actually went in and they were doing a bunch of reshoots. And when they were doing that, they filmed themselves reading the actual comment section. So I know that that was part of it, but I don't know if that character's lines or any of that was changed in any way.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And shockingly, as much as I think you're totally right in that character exemplifying fragile masculinity and sort of, you know, his own, you know, being caught up in that sort of thing, that character is almost completely absent from any discussion in any of the comment section controversy.
Mm-hmm. Really?
At least that I've seen. I'm sure it's out there, but I haven't encountered it yet.
My gosh, the invisibility is just stunning.
I mean, if anything, you know, people are just upset that, you know, oh, these people call themselves feminists, but, you know, here is this person who's being objectified and no one seems to care. So, you know, there's some of that, but very little, like, more robust discussion about that character than that moment right there.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Just basically being upset that he's being objectified and how dare they. That's like the extent, I think.
My goodness.
Of what I've read.
I have a question then about the backlash, because I remember there being a backlash. I remember there being attempts to sort of kill the movie, basically, to like not get people to see the movie, to down talk the movie a lot before it came out, which incidentally also happened right before Bridesmaids. I remember very distinctly there were one or two, legitimate journalists, not just sort of commenters, who kept talking about how what a big mistake it was to release Bridesmaids. Nobody's going to go to this movie. And then this was this huge success. So it feels like a thing that comes up for Paul Feig on a, you know, on at least two occasions. But can you talk us through a little bit of the sort of pre-movie backlash, like the feelings as the movie was sort of about to come out?
Yeah, that's actually what I have done a lot of research on, is kind of leading up to the film. And the film trailer was posted on YouTube several months before the actual film came out. And between the time it was posted and the theater launch date of the film, there were something like 240,000 comments in the comment section of this film, and became the most disliked movie trailer of all time up to that point. And a lot of the people who were posting really heavily and who were really upset about this film were very adamant that they were not upset that the movie was being remade with four women in the lead, but that they were really upset that Hollywood keeps relying on reboots and sequels, and that this was their big chance to like really stick it to Sony for making yet another reboot. And so a lot of the focus was really on, you know, when they would like interview people who were commenting or who were really mad, like, this isn't about the women in the film. This is about, you know, this is about sequels, and this is about the way Hollywood is funded. And we're, you know, on their high horse about that. So the study that I did actually delved into the comments and only looked at the comments up until opening day. So like, then none of these comments could be actually about the movie, because no one had seen it yet.
Had seen it. Yeah.
And really just sort of dove headfirst into what the internet trolls or harassers were saying about this film. And the deeper you get into the comment section, the more you can see just without a doubt that it actually is very much about the fact that there are four women in charge. And kind of the argument that I make is that they're employing misogyny as this mechanism that has, of course, implications for the film. You know, they were, you know, trying to get to 1 million dislikes before the launch date, and they got close, but they didn't make it quite, and became the sort of game they were playing. But they also, you know, tried to encourage people to vote the film down on Rotten Tomatoes and vote the film down on IMDb and a bunch of other places. And so it had impacts on the film in that way. What I think is really interesting about the comment section is not only what's there, because I've got a lot of stuff on what's there. If you want to hear about it, it's not particularly uplifting.
Yeah.
But it's also just that a lot of people talked about the comment section and talked about this harassment that was occurring in the comment section as being this like exceptionally bad thing that happens in comment sections. And kind of what I try to argue in the work that I do is that it's actually really not that exceptional. If you think about it, this type of harassment happens online all the time. And even if you look at the type of harassment that happened specifically against Leslie Jones, which is this like very racist, gendered form of harassment, that even that's not that exceptional, because we know that women of color experience this type of harassment in online spaces much more severely. And then also, it's really not that exceptional, because when you look at the world we live in, this type of harassment actually, and some of the things people say, it actually mirrors very closely the harassment people face. So yes, there were tons of threats of sexual assault and of shootings and of violence against women in the comment section. But we don't live in a world that's especially hospitable to women. We live in a world that's actually very dangerous for women, and many women experience these types of things. And so, you know, I think what happened in that space is really tragic. And what happens in comment spaces and in online spaces for women is very tragic. But we need to remember that we're by excusing it, we are also suggesting that it's normal, or, you know, that you can look away, or, you know, of course you shouldn't be welcome on the internet. You know, you can just turn it off. You should be silent about this. And in that way, it sort of kind of like condones the whole thing and condones what's happening when we just sort of excuse that.
That's really fascinating. The idea that that's not a separate thing, right? That's that's fascinating. We talk about a virtual world, but as though it has no like reflection in the of the real world in some way.
Right. The way that we separate those things out is so amazing to me. And, you know, I especially think about the way then that that type of narrative, like just turn it off, just go away from it, actually mirrors the exact way that we talk to victims of online and digital harassment. Right. We tell people who are victims of that type of harassment to just don't go online, just delete your Facebook account. And that's not the root of the problem. The root of the problem is actually like a very mechanized form of misogyny that's being enacted for a specific purpose. And we need to address that a lot better than we do. We also need to recognize that when we tell people to just like ignore it and be silent about it, that's like the exact problem in the first place, is that we tell women to be quiet.
Not only does it mirror other narratives in the discussion of, you know, this virtual world in quotes, but it has uncomfortable ties to how we treat survivors in the real world as well. That it's, you know, that immediately the onus is on the person coming forward to change their behavior or excuse what has happened to them because of some sort of circumstantial bullshit. Good podcast, everybody. I guess we'll just go home. We were talking right before we turned on the mics about how Dana and I are both in academia, but in different ways. Actually, Tobin too, right? You teach college. Yeah.
I do.
I forgot about that for just a hot second. So let's talk about just the opening in terms of academics, because it's a huge, the way things like tenure and the way professors are portrayed in TV and movies is often a huge pet peeve of mine. A huge example is Ross Geller on Friends. He taught one class and then he got tenure. Which is ridiculous. But so I'm interested in, for the other academics in the room, kind of how the opening bits with Kristen Wiig going up for tenure. And I, of course, immediately wrote down dictating her clothing to her. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, something that happens. So how did the fake-ademia work for you two just there at the beginning?
So I'm going up for tenure this fall, and just the like, the horror I think I feel about the process, even in a university like mine where the process is very straightforward, but just the microaggressions, the belittling of certain types of work. I mean, to me, while I think it's, you know, it's obviously done in a way that tries to exaggerate for effect. Mm-hmm. It also, I think, plays up what are like the biggest fears I have in my work. So, you know, to me, I was like, uh-oh, that's right. So, yeah.
You were taking notes for a different reason than I was taking notes.
right, exactly.
I mean, I don't know about you, Dana. When I was in grad school and teaching as a grad student for the first few times, we had lots of discussions about what we would wear and why. And it was started by either older graduate students or advisors in seminars and things. But then it became something that we were very conscious of in my cohort about how to look in that space. Is that something you experienced?
All the time, and very much so around the job market, because we were given a lot of prep where I did my PhD work on like how to land a big wig kind of job. So they would say things like, don't wear too many colors, don't wear anything too short. And it became clear that there was just nothing that was going to be professional enough, or like faculty members. There have been several instances in grad school where faculty members would comment on grad students' clothing, you know, like, yes. Sometimes in a very harassing way, and other times in just like a more subtly harassing way, like, oh, did you wear that to teach? So I felt like that was always there. And then it showed up in student evaluations, yes, where my students would like comment on what I was wearing or what shoes I had on.
All,
like every term I would get that kind of thing. And, you know, I still get it. I still get comments on that from faculty members. I mean, I expect some of it from students, but from my colleagues, I'll get comments and male colleagues in front of students calling out what I'm wearing, or, you know, I know a lot of folks who have had that experience. So, oh yeah, it's like a stunningly present thing is what I wear every day. Or if I wear pants, usually at least one person will be like, oh, you rarely wear pants. Right. And it becomes like a conversation piece about, you know, all the time. All the time.
It was a strange adjustment to go to the staff side in a lot of ways for me. But one of them was figuring out what rules were different or not. You know, us ladies, we could talk about our clothes all day.
Well, we're asked to, though.
Yeah, no, right? Exactly. No, yes, exactly.
And then when we talk about our clothes, they're like, oh, you're talking about your clothes?
Exactly. Right. Yeah, but there's
the only person who can comment on your physical appearance is me.
Right. I mean, can you imagine saying the same things to male colleagues that are said to you? Like,
no. And actually, in my first teaching job right out of school, I was talking about how I always get comments about my clothes. And I worked with someone who was like, he was also a professor, and he was young, and he was cool. You know, he wore cool clothes. And I mean, he was way cooler than I'll ever be. And I was like, you must get this too, right? And he was like, I have never once had that happen to me. And I was blown away. What? This happens to me every term. Right. Are you serious? I mean, it's, yeah.
Tobin, where do you fit in? Are you that cool guy that no one cares what you wear?
I'm certainly not that cool guy, but being a guy, no one cares.
The part that I wrote down after my pet peeves about the portrayal of academia is, as you know, it is sort of the 10-year process that has the Aaron, the Kristen Wiig character, up in arms about this book that she'd written previously with a colleague that gets her back together with Abby, played by Melissa McCarthy. And just in that first, when even the three of them, before we even get Patty, but when the three of them are first on screen together, I wrote down how much I love seeing people be good at their jobs. And particularly, I love to see women portrayed as good at their jobs. And so I knew that there were going to be, that they would get jerked around, et cetera. But just what competent, like, well, you know, I don't, yeah, it's so sad that I have to compliment people being competent, but but I love that they, Aaron is certainly trying to reconcile these different identities she has around the ghosts, but they're never self-deprecating. They're never, I mean, so I guess maybe she does have some shame around her experience, but on the whole, they're confident in a number of ways that I appreciated seeing even before they got the big guns.
And confident in each other and supportive of each other, which, like, that happens all the time in the real world. So to get to see it on film, like, really smart women working together and encouraging each other. Mm-hmm. Yep. I'll take it.
I liked it.
There was a great moment to jump ahead in the movie where it's before they walk into one of the, I can't remember where, but near the climax of the movie, and the four of them show up and they're in this four shot in the middle of the screen, all in their gear. And it's the hero moment of where one of them is going to say, let's go, to like go into the building to take care of the ghost. And Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig say it at the same time. And then they both stop. Say, oh, you're going to, okay, you go ahead. Oh, okay. You do it. But then what they're saying is, okay, you do it this time, I'll do it next time. Like, it's not, they're not trying to elbow each other out. They're like, okay, yeah, you got it. Okay, great. You do it this time. Like, we just didn't coordinate this, you know? Like, it's a different, there's the comedy in this movie does not come from a mean-spirited place. And the comedy in this movie does not come from the fact that they're silly, or not, silly is not the right word, they are incompetent.
There's no bumbling.
Right?
There's
no bumbling. Yeah. They've taken the Gillian Holtzman character, the Kate McKinnon character, and she, the comedy comes because she is so fucking good at her job. Like, she's creating things that you know, probably, or not probably, they're likely physically impossible. Like, physics does not allow her to do the things that she's able to do. But she's so good, she whips this stuff up, which is, I think that's one of the real joys of this movie.
I wrote down, I love the I believe you moment. And now I don't remember exactly where it is. It's after Patty joins them, but before that big battle in the hotel that causes the mayor to be upset with them. So I apologize for not remembering that specifically. But yeah, there is a camaraderie and a support of each other that is sometimes, earning that is like half the movie. I'm thinking of Avengers-y stuff where, like, we don't trust this person and that person, we don't know about them, and they have to show us. And I think they are open to collaboration in a way that we don't always see.
Who is your favorite performance of the four? I know it's a hard question. I apologize.
I think Catherine McKinnon, it just knocked it out of the park. And I was drawn to her in a lot of scenes. But I also read an interview that Melissa McCarthy and Paul Feig did. And they talked about how that portrayal was actually the closest to her actual personality that it gets, right? Like, he kept being like, play yourself. And she was struggling with it. And she was like, nervous. And he's like, nope, this is exactly right. So I thought that was sort of interesting.
Yeah. I, I guess that the question I would ask instead is maybe what do you like best about each of them? Because I don't have one that I pick, although I do have a game later. So maybe keep some of that in mind. Tobin, do you have a favorite that jumps out at you?
I do. I guess I didn't mean to. We had to pick a favorite of the, but the favorite performance that I have is Kate McKinnon. I think she is she's becoming a national treasure on the Julia Louis Dreyfus order.
Tobin does not throw that term around, but once you get that sticker of national treasure, you keep it. So this is important.
And I have seen a total of one episode of Seinfeld. So it's basically just Veep and her persona outside, like her sort of celebrity persona. That's my Julia Louis-Dreyfus is a national treasure. But I think it's really true. And I think that Kate McKinnon is approaching that. She does things with this character that shouldn't work. There's one part she's going over to a knock on the door. I think it's when Melissa McCarthy has been possessed by the ghost. So she's going over to knock on the door and she's just like four voices calling to her on her way to the door that really shouldn't, like they shouldn't all work in one character, but they do. And I was so in the movie every time she was on screen. I just loved her energy in the movie. Doesn't mean I didn't like the other ones too, but that was.
Yeah, she's just unapologetically weird and like dynamic, and it's just so many things. Like, we don't get to see women doing that in a role where they're like simultaneously being taken seriously as a genius.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I like the juxtaposition of Kate McKinnon and Kristen Wiig, because I think in a previous era or iteration, Kristen Wiig would have been asked to be the wacky one. I think of some of her SNL characters, some of which I care for, some of which I don't, that are just kind of bananas in one way or another. And so I, the more I think about it, I really appreciate the, I know this is a summer blockbuster movie, but like the depth of the Kristen Wiig character, both in just looking at her compared to how she might have played it, because we know that she has that in her as well. But then I was struck by toward the end. So we're just flopping all over this time, which I think is fine because everyone knows that's what this movie's about. But they get to Rowan's lair in the basement of the hotel, and he has a little mini villain monologue kind of thing. And I do love the, I think it's Holtzman that says it's always the sad, pale ones. yes. But what it seems to me is that Rowan and Aaron had a similar background. They were both marginalized. They both had thoughts or experiences or things that made them different and that they struggled with. But then what they did with that and how they reconciled it put them on opposite trajectories. And
God, that's a great point.
I don't know about that, but I like that. Then that brought it back around to me of masculinity is so fragile. Not to say that men don't have the opportunity or you know, folks of any identity don't have the opportunity to sort of navigate in a different way. But this was just a real stark, like, somebody who felt entitlement and felt disappointed by the world would go in that way. And then the other side you get would be the Aaron searching to discover and kind of use that power for good.
I love that reading of this movie. I love that reading of this movie.
And that seems to agree with me, Dana. So
so this is big.
It's a real night of highs and lows here. Dana, you mentioned specifically some of the backlash to Leslie Jones that was racialized, and then we saw that come up again around the Olympics when she was tweeting. Are there other what kind of other examples of the kind of intersectionality of the trolls kind of came out for you when you did your work?
That was a huge one. And one of the things I thought was really interesting is that when she was being attacked on Twitter, that it got a lot of attention. But if you look at the comments section, she was already being attacked in those very similar racist ways months earlier. And so, and that got almost no attention. So I thought that was fairly interesting. And then she was also, Melissa McCarthy and Leslie Jones were also specifically attacked a lot in the comment section for their appearance in ways that involved, you know, like basically talking about their physical size, their presence on the screen, that sort of thing. And it was really contrasted with the way, because of course people talked about Catherine McKinnon and Kristen Wiig a lot as well, but they did a lot more in like sexually objectifying ways. So like talking about like basically wanting to sexually assault them all the time and, you know, things like that. So it was just a really different, like it was, there was a real sort of dichotomy between the, like, how dare you have a human body and be out in public kind of criticism of Melissa McCarthy and Leslie Jones versus the very objectifying, very sexually explicit and demeaning objectifying language against like the two white stereotypically attractive and thin people. So we saw that. There's also a lot of ways that this gender intersected with homophobia.
So that was going to be my next question. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are, I mean, hundreds of references to the word dyke, most commonly things like dyke busters or, you know, Ghostbusters, fat dyke edition, things like that. So just so many comments along those lines is unbelievable. And so there's a lot of those types of things. But really interestingly, also a lot. So when men in particular in the comment section would say they liked the movie or stick up for another person who is kind of, you know, saying they liked the movie and being harassed online, they would often accuse them of like these really interesting things. Like they use the term white knight a lot, which is like a man who's posing as a feminist so he can get laid. I had to look that up on Urban Dictionary because I'm not cool enough. I was like, what is this term? But so a lot of that type of language. And there was also a lot of homophobic language leveled against men who said they were going to watch the film. So like against the audience itself, like only gay men would want to watch this film, I guess. So there was a lot of that in there. I think those are the ones that really stick out to me the most, but I could probably go on and on and on and on.
It's so upsetting.
This homophobia was also really coupled with this like homosocial behavior. So the comment section actually seemed to become a place where men would bond with each other over harassing other people. And it became this just like really toxic, masculine, homosocial environment where anyone who stood up for the film, then men would sort of like team up and they would Google that person and find out personal information about them and report it back to the thread. And, you know, publish that type of information, or they would one up each other and it would become this sort of like bros high fiving, but about like misogyny and about threatening violence. I mean, they were like threatening to shoot everyone. And I mean, just some of the language is so ridiculous that it's almost funny, except that they're like still advocating to like rape people and rip their faces off and stuff. Right. So it's not, but it became like this homophobia is like juxtaposed with then this very homosocial, toxic, masculine environment where they are basically like slapping each other's asses while they commit harassment.
Jeez. That's wildly upsetting. How did you cleanse yourself? Doing this work. Oh, really? Is that where you were going to?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah.
So I would delve into the comment section, but only allow myself to do it for a few hours. And then I would go play with my dog or my kid. So like I would do this and then be like, all right, that's it. We're all going to the slides on the park. That's what we're doing right now. But it was really difficult to just immerse yourself in this world of hate and know that pretty much no one did anything to curb this behavior. They were just excusing it and being like, oh, you know how the internet is. It's upsetting. It's really upsetting. It's not exactly the kind of research that you do when you want to feel good about yourself or the world in any way. Yeah.
Right. But I think, you know, adding a looking at it the way you did and pointing out the sort of lack of justice in it all and really distilling it down to, you know, some of those patterns and things, I think works for the good of us, so that we can know what to do next time, hopefully. Mm-hmm. and how to disrupt some of that or all of that if possible. So thank mm-hmm. you for your service on that. Sounds like a terrible day on the internet.
Right? I just remembered one thing that reminds me of what you were saying before about really liking seeing women who are competent at their job. Another really big thread in the comment section was saying that it in the trailer when they showed women being good at their job, that was one of the things that people complained about that made the movie seem unrealistic, because like women could never really be good at math or science. They could never really be experts in that field. And that they also, it was like laughable to think that women could be physically strong enough to do some of the ghost fighting that they did later in the movie. And that was, I mean, so many comments of people, and not just being like, oh, that's stupid, women are dumb, but like having very lengthy explanations for exactly what about women in math and science was really difficult for them to understand, or like pointing out the, like using stats, like the low numbers of women who are physicists as evidence that this was unrealistic. So, so like taking this thing that we're like, yeah, feminists are like, yeah, we need to work on that, and being like, no, this is actually evidence that like women really can't do it. Oh, very well researched comment section.
It sounds like it. I feel like I would find myself screaming into the computer a lot for that.
Maybe a
lighter side. Can we talk about Chris Hemsworth in this movie a little bit?
Yeah.
I mean, since we're all tired of talking about women.
Speaking of someone who's not good at his job.
Right. Yeah. The only truly incompetent person.
Yes.
Is right. him. Yes. And I'll say mine because it's on the tip of my tongue, then I'll stop. I didn't mind it most of the time until the end. Like, when really it was just like, oh, Kevin, you're such a scamp. When he was like taking credit for the things that happened and went and got a sandwich instead of helping. And like that, like at that point, I wish that Abby would have been like, all right, you're done. And then there could be something funny where, you know, Aaron wants to go with him or whatever. But it was fine. It wasn't my favorite parts. It was okay. But at that point, by the end, it wasn't funny anymore for me, just because it was so like, oh, of course you didn't help, but you want credit. Like, I don't know. Where are other people with this plot line? Or I don't know if it's actually plot.
It reminds me of my issue with the end of Spy, which I still think is probably so far is my favorite movie of Paul Feig's. But then, and that undercuts itself with having Melissa McCarthy in bed with Jason Statham in the post-credit sequence, which is like,
so close.
Because you were going out on such a high. Yeah. And this had that feeling to me too. I was hoping that maybe Aaron would be the one to say, Kristen Wiig would say, oh, okay, never, I'm no longer infatuated by you. Or, you know, like, because they'd played that for such laughs all the way along that that they could have had her turn there at the end. I don't know. It felt lazy in the same way that it did at the end of Spy. It felt like it's just where so much of the humor has been so smart that this then just wasn't.
I would agree with both of the things you've already said, but there's also this part of me that was like, not at all mad that they were objectifying this man. And like, don't get me wrong, I don't think this is the answer to things,
right.
But I thought it was very interesting to hear men be like, this person is just objectified, mm-hmm. and to be able to be like, oh, really? Tell me more about that. Right. And like hook them in this logic where then you could be like, yeah, oh, I know.
Yeah, right? point to every other media product that exists. And
right. Like, yeah, that must be really hard that one movie had that one thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
You poor fellas.
Yeah. So Well, like I said, well, I think the ultimate goal is that nobody is. I did appreciate it a little bit for that. They didn't appreciate it in the comment section, I promise you that.
Sure, yeah. I'm sure. But I feel like everyone knew what that joke was. And I'm saying that, you know, in a good way. It wasn't, you know, we were.
Right.
At that moment, we were all like, oh, we're turning it on its head. And with who better than, you know, a Thor.
And Thor. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I love a behind the scenes. And so I enjoy how much they enjoyed him in it and how he, you know, he was part of the joke. And because he is part of these other giant, you know, CGI masterpieces, that that he was down to play. Yeah, the because there are, you know, stereotypes and expectations around pretty people of all identities. So like I was glad he was there to play in the sandbox. But I would have just liked them to, like you say, Tobin, take the smarter route there at the end.
Right? Yeah. Stick the landing with him. Yeah. Yeah. He is great though. And he's really fun, I think, in the movie, and seems to be, is a good foil for them. And highlights the idea that they are so good at what they do, given how, and it also highlights sort of the way they work together and accept one another and do things for one another. And, you know, that they're like, we're going to keep, you know, like
we're
before that last scene.
Puppy.
Yeah. We're going to keep the puppy. Yeah, exactly. Which I thought was great.
I'll also say one more like kind of Debbie Downer thing about his inclusion, that one of the things I teach in my advertising class is that when we have an increasing number of like images of men being objectified, and there's all sorts of problems with that, because we also see that men have really fast growing rates of disordered eating and things like that. But when men are objectified, at least in advertising, one big trend in that is to do it in that sort of tongue-in-cheek way where like we're all in on this joke. And so it's easy to kind of excuse it because we're sort of in on the joke. And it then like kind of minimizes the way that actually has these bad ramifications for men. But also when women are objectified, they're just like naked laying on a bench advertising shoes or something, you know?
Right.
So it just looks a lot different, and it sort of mirrors that, which, you know, can take that for what it is, but it seems to be a trend that we're seeing a lot of now.
That's interesting. I'll have to, and now I'm going to look out for that. What about all our cameos?
This is my big issue with the movie, is that maybe too strong a word, but where I fault the movie is it's sometimes it feels like it's tying itself in knots to make nods to the original movie. And, you know, the cameos are fun. Like cameos are great. And I love that Bill Murray gets like destroyed by this goat. Like I like some of what they do with it. I really like it when Sigourney Weaver shows up.
Well, you always like it when Sigourney Weaver shows up.
I do. I love some Sigourney Weaver, but I felt like it was, and other times too, when it would be like, we know the movie's called Ghostbusters. We know that there's you know, part of this, you know, lineage of ghostbusting. And so like as they come up with the name, like that becomes part of the thing. Like it felt like some of the plot points and humor, there'd be like cul-de-sacs in the movie to explain a new reason for why this stuff's happening as opposed to the way it had happened before. And I get a little tired with that on a narrative, because I want to keep going with like, stick with these women and the story in this movie and see what's happening, as opposed to like have to nod to things that happened in the past. And I felt like the cameos, you know, the cameos themselves didn't detract for me, but they didn't add much for me. What about you two?
I would agree with that. And I think part of the reason they were in there is because when Paul Feig took the role, he said that anyone who wanted a cameo could be in it. And so I think he probably actually was writing for the people who were like, I'll do it. I'd like that.
The first time that there was a line that started to sing the song, I thought it was cute. And then like by the third time, It just got less cute to me. It felt pandery to me that, like, okay, everyone's really touchy about this, so we want to really show you that the folks who were in it before are giving their blessing to this one.
Right. Exactly.
And I think in point. This climate that they were in, they did sort of have to do that. I was just tired of it. And then this does give me the opportunity to share that I am an unashamed fan of Fall Out Boy. So I enjoyed their
That's the biggest confession you've had on our 19 episodes of the show.
The renovation of the original thing. And so it's a different podcast to talk about when and how and why I have loved Fall Out Boy, but I thought it was a choice that made me laugh. And then some of the cameos made me laugh, and then some of them didn't. And I was just like, okay, let's just wrap it up, folks. Like, who else do we need to see? It was a mixed bag for me.
Aislinn, you said you'd watched the original movie recently. Is that right? Can you tell, cause I haven't seen it since probably the early 90s, or maybe even the late 80s. It's been a long time since I've seen it. Is it? My memory is that the humor in it is more mean-spirited, which may be just sort of filtered through time. But how would you describe the difference between the humor in the original and the humor in the reboot?
I mean, I think obviously that layer of winking about it is not there, right? Because it's not an homage to anything. I would agree that it's more mean-spirited. I think that, in this one, we don't see Rowan, the bad guy, we don't see him being bullied or being belittled or demeaned. And you do see the sort of a similar character in, what is his name? Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Rick Moranis.
Yeah.
You do see Rick Moranis feeling left out, but also exemplifying some of those things we were talking about earlier, where really he just feels entitled to Sigourney Weaver's attention and he's not getting it. Like, so that plays differently. I knew when I was supposed to laugh in the original, but watching it as an adult many years after it came out, I didn't find it super funny. Sorry. Can't wait for my comments. And I, obviously the special effects and things are very different in a different time and place, but I felt more sincerely frightened. Like the original is creepier to me than this was.
Oh, is it? Well, part of my question is because my 7-year-old son would really like to watch Ghostbusters, and I've been holding off on it partly because I haven't seen it. I sort of wanted to check it out again before, because, you run into things that you remember one way from your childhood and you start showing them to your children. Absolutely. And you're like, oh, wow, this is much more problematic. So I'm wondering if we should just start with this one.
I think so. I mean, I feel like it's just come back up in the news, something about the ghost giving a blowjob scene. So I don't know how many blowjob scenes your son has seen. And there is a real, Bill Murray, I found really creepy and, what's the word? Predatory in the rewatch. He's, doing what we're joking that they're doing to Chris Hemsworth, but he, invites himself into her house and is just very, very, very creepy about it. I don't know. I think start with this one on that. I don't know. Dana, have you seen the old one recently?
No, I have not.
Well,
I will report back after I.
Do you remember seeing the sequel in the theater, Tobe?
I do. I remember the theater that we went to. It became a cult church that then fell apart a couple of years ago.
Yes. Why did we remember that? But
I don't know.
Shout out to Paw. Paw took us to that movie.
I for one was
scarred by it because Peter McNichol is so frightening to me still because of that. But I remember it very. Memories.
Yeah.
Do y'all want to play a game?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
The game is entitled, Who Are You Gonna Call?
Okay.
And so similar to the discussion we had earlier about favorites or who's good in what scenario, let's think about our four protagonists, Aaron, Abby, Patty, or Holtzman. And I'm going to give you a circumstance, and you're going to tell me, in that circumstance, who are you going to call? Who do you want on your team for that scenario?
I love it.
So I don't know if we can also hashtag this like we did Witch, but with who are you going to call?
Yeah.
So of those four, if you, for whatever reason, needed to crash a wedding, who are you going to call? Who are you going to bring with you to crash a wedding?
Do I want to have fun or do I want to go undetected?
Ooh, that's a great point.
Great question.
How about undetected? Who would help you be undetected, do you think?
Kristen Wiig.
Mm-hmm. Tobin, who are you going to call?
That was my first instinct, but I think even though this maybe leaves her out for a future thing where she might be better suited, I would love to see how Holtzman would deal with a wedding. Just for sheer entertainment value, it'd be like the sort of soft comments or, you know, quiet comments. Mm-hmm. I would definitely take Holtzman to the wedding.
Oh, that'd be great.
What about you, Aslan?
I mean, they would all be fantastic. But I was leaning toward Holtzman as well. It would be hard to keep a straight face because I feel like if we were crashing, we'd be lying, and the story would just get more fantastical every relative she talked to. But it would certainly be a lot of fun. Okay, number two, who are you going to call to help talk your way out of a parking ticket or a traffic ticket of some kind?
I'm going to go with Patty. I loved Patty. I loved the Leslie Jones character in this movie. And I feel like, especially if we were in New York and given her MTA, she would know the right tactic to use with the traffic cop, whether it's bluster or flattery, or I feel like she'd be really good at that.
I think I'm going to go with Abby on this one. Because doesn't she just like convince everyone that this is the plan that they're going to use anyway? I mean, Yeah, that's kind of her role at the beginning of the film. So I'm just going to go all in and she can do some more convincing.
Okay. Number three, who are you going to call to sit next to you on a plane ride to Thailand?
Is it use everyone once? Are there rules to this game? Are there rules?
No, there's no rules.
Oh, no. Oh, I was trying to only use everyone.
I think you can use it more than once.
Okay.
I definitely want to sit next to Kristen Wiig, but only if it's Kristen Wiig's bridesmaids character, which is probably not the rules of this game. Otherwise, I would definitely want to sit next to Patty because I think we would have just the most fun.
I would definitely not want Melissa McCarthy's bridesmaids character, but I would want Abby next to me in this because I think she would be really like, because that would be from where I live, that would be a long trip, and I feel like she'd be great company on a long trip, and including if we needed quiet time, I feel like she could say let's not talk right now. You wouldn't have to talk the whole time, and so yeah, I'd definitely say Abby.
I feel like I'd get the best plane snacks if Abby was sitting next to me. She has that ongoing repartee with the food delivery guy.
With Benny.
And so I feel like she would sort of stand up for our rights in our row, but would also be a very interesting conversationalist. And so I think Abby's a good choice. Who are you going to call to bail you out of jail?
Maybe Holtzman again, because I bet you could have some contraption to like blow the wall out of the jail.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Oh, that's a really hard one. I think I would have to agree. And also just because I feel like she could do something that would distract people where like they would be watching her and maybe I could break out.
Nice. Excellent. Excellent.
You know, another one, maybe to, if I could, an addendum to that, maybe Cecily Strong's character, ooh, Jennifer Lynch.
Yeah.
Because she could actually get me out of jail, given her connections to the mayor.
She could.
There's that.
I feel like I would ask Erin to come because I would trust that she wouldn't tell anyone.
Yeah, good point.
That way. And then finally, who would you take as a guest to a departmental meeting at your institution?
Pre-tenure or post-tenure?
Exactly.
Pre-tenure, I would take Erin because she would be quiet and not make waves. Post-tenure, I would definitely bring Patty and I would pass her notes of things that I would want her to say out loud that I didn't want to say myself. And then she could just yell them out and it would be perfect.
Perfect. I love it.
That's great. I
love it. Tobe?
I think any one of them would be good for different reasons. I guess I'm going to take Abby with me because, I don't have to go to a lot of faculty meetings, thankfully, anymore. But, when I do, there's always some sort of like this, they can be very stressful sometimes. Mm. And so, sometimes? And I don't, once in a while they're known to be a little stressful and you don't always know like the history of the politics of the room you're in, so having someone there who would just calm me, I think she'd be soothing. I don't know, what do you think?
Well, I made up the game so I can cheat. Also, I am the only grown-up who currently works in my department, so I'm gonna bring them all. They're all welcome. Nice. In my house.
Nice.
And so that would be fun. And then if we turned it into, you know, a party. And I also think my students could learn a lot from each of them.
Mm.
So I would put them on a panel.
Oh, that's a good idea.
But again, I'm cheating because I made up the game. Thank you all for playing. If our listeners want to play, hashtag who you gonna call and tell us in these scenarios or make up new scenarios for us. We would love to play. We've enjoyed playing Pie Share and Witch. So let's keep the conversation going.
Great game, Aslan.
Yes, yeah. Great.
Now that we have had our discussion and we've had our fun, it's time to give our final judgment. Is this progressive or regressive? Is this movie a step forward or a step back for fearless women in front of and behind the camera? Dana, what do you think?
I have a lot of thoughts on this. I think the comments that section, notwithstanding, that it is a step forward. And I think the stars of this film were unapologetic about the work they did on this film and were proud of it and showed that they were going to stand tall, even in the face of this just unbelievable types of harassment. And then, like I said, I mean, I haven't been to a major blockbuster film where women could do this type of work while also wearing clothing. And that, mm-hmm. it's really remarkable. And then I'll also say the one thing we didn't really talk about, but that was a big controversy around the film, was Leslie Jones' character and how she was the only one who was not a scientist and also the only woman of color. And I think those criticisms are really valid. And I definitely didn't buy the argument that, like, well, if you look at the originals, the person of color was also, you know, not a scientist. But it's like, are we really going to rely on this like historical film?
Right.
To, you know, so I definitely didn't buy that as a legitimate reason that we couldn't have done more with her character. And then I'll also say that she just knocked it out of the park, and which she mm-hmm. was so proud of the work she did. And I, you know, I've also seen interviews where she, you know, was talking about being a role model for women of color and showing them that they can be this thing and be successful. And so, so there, I'll give it a, like, I don't get to decide on that one, but overall I thought it was fantastic. And there's a lot of good precedent for dealing with this type of thing going forward that we learned from this movie. So I would say progressive.
Awesome. Thank you. Tobin, how about you?
I co-sign all previous comments, and will only add that the action sequences in this movie are beautifully shot and beautifully choreographed. It's something that I don't think Paul Feig gets quite enough credit for between this and Spy and Heat. And I guess also even the choreography, not of action stunts, but physical comedy in Bridesmaids. They're often at the ends of these movies, these CGI extravaganzas, the end, the last battle. Like I walked out of Man of Steel for a lot of reasons, but like, cause I knew the end was just going to be this big long fist fight with all this computer graphics and stuff. And I was invested not only in who these characters were, but also in his ability to clearly define the action and the stakes. And I was sort of gripped by this last sequence, which I'm not always in these films. So I really enjoyed this movie, and I'm glad I own it, and I will show it to my son. And when my daughter is older, to her, and I definitely would come down on the progressive side. Aislinn, what do you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I was not as quite invested in the final battle. It got loud and whatever for me, but like Dana said, seeing four women do their jobs great and care for each other and go to literally the ends of the earth to make sure that their team comes out on top, I loved. So is it perfect? No, but I think progressive, yes. And I'm glad it's out there, and I hope to watch it with you all when you watch it in your household, Tobin.
Yes, that would be fun. Definitely. The next movie we're going to do is directed by Jodie Foster, starring Holly Hunter. We're going to do Home for the Holidays for Thanksgiving, even though now we know Aislinn doesn't like holiday themed episodes. This comes out, will come out on November 13th in 2 weeks. So come back and check out Home for the Holidays. Dana, thank you so much for joining us and for having this great discussion with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
If people want to find you or your work and compliment you and learn more about what you do, if you want to be found, where do you want to be found?
The best way to find me at this point is to send me an email, and we can maybe link to that in the show notes.
Definitely.
Yes. I'm working on a book project on this project around Ghostbusters right now, and I'm teamed up with a bunch of other researchers who are bringing in work that they're doing on women strong films. So, and some of the reception issues around that. So, but it's not out yet. So I'm hesitant to give you the name because it's not finalized. So the best way to get a hold of me is to email me.
Dana, will you come back to talk about your work more and other things and other movies with us sometime?
Oh my gosh, yes. Okay. Absolutely, yes.
Yay.
Yes. I'm such a nerd for this, so yes.
I love it. Okay. Fabulous. We'll have a panel of our own.
Yes.
Academic women. Tobin is still blackmailing me into doing Twitter, so you can find me at SassyNerdMT on Twitter. And I do have to report, I did get my first email from my Cage Club email.
Ooh, wow, yay.
So that was pretty exciting. Yay, ding, ding, ding. Tobin, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Tobin Addington, and you can find us on Twitter at contenders_pod or at facebook.com/thecontenderspod. So do us a favor, leave us a review, reach out to us, talk to us, play the game online. We love it. It makes us feel all warm and fuzzy inside.
We here at The Contenders are proud members of the Cage Club Podcast Network. You can explore all their great shows at cageclub.me. And you can keep tabs on all the Cage Club happenings on Twitter at Cage Club Pod. Hey, Tobe, what's a new Cage Club happening?
So the Cage Club show Watch the Throne is how they're describing it. This is the Charlize Theron podcast. They've come to the end, or they're coming to the end of the run of that podcast. And they as Joey and Mike always do at the end of these, they're having an awards show where they're going to nominate and give out awards for, you know, best performance and all that in her filmography. They're calling it the Chrome Teeth nominations, the Chrome Teeth Awards from the Mad Max Fury Road character, Furiosa. So head on over to Cage Club.com Me and they're easy to find links to go find that out and yeah, put in your nominations and vote for some awards.
I love awards. I will be heading there shortly. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'm Aislinn Addington.
And I'm Dana Showalter.
I'm Tobin Addington, and we'll see you next time on The Contenders.
See, that's why we have you on, because you're so smart.
I am a doctor. Yeah,
I'm surrounded by doctors. I love
this. I know. I wrote down all this professory stuff.
So I have this pain in my elbow. And...
right.
Yeah. I'm hoping that you break into the Spies Like Us doctor.
Yeah, we should.